Well, good morning, and I do greet you in the worthy name of Jesus, the one that went to the cross for us. Enjoyed being here this morning. Enjoyed the Sunday school discussion. Lots of new perspectives that I will look at that story with. Well, I thought I knew what I was going to share this morning. I got up early Friday morning and had the better part of it done. And got up early to study and was studying there. And just had this clear sense that it wasn't for here and it wasn't for now, and I'm not sure why. But we left it where it was, and I planned to bring, or felt led to bring, a message here on one of my favorite Bible characters. So, children, do you know who the man was that the king said he must die for eating a little bit of honey? People said, no, he shouldn't die, and the people won, and he wasn't killed. Do you know who it was? Not. I mean, you know him. You know him, but it's not just like the most popular Bible character, but I'm sure you know him. Tasted a little honey when he wasn't supposed to, and the king said, you will die. Anybody? Any of the children still? No. Yes. Jonathan. Thank you. That's right. Jonathan. That's an interesting story there. King says, you're going to die. As the Lord liveth, you will die. And the people all protested and said, no, he shouldn't, because he helped win a great victory. And the king says, okay, I guess you're right. It's interesting. I always wondered why that happened that way, because as the Lord liveth, I mean, he was like making a statement. But if you remember, this was after the Lord had departed from Saul. And so that statement is probably worthless. So anyway, I'm not planning to talk about that incident, though. Jonathan. I guess if you're looking for a title, I don't have any fancy title. Jonathan, heroic faith, undaunting courage. That would be what I would title it. So just to give us a little background on Jonathan, he most likely had a godly upbringing, I would imagine. His father, Saul, King Saul as we know him, seems to have been an humble man when he became king. If you'll remember, when he was, 1 Samuel 10, 22 is, therefore they inquired of the Lord further if the man should yet come thither. And the Lord answered, behold, he hath hid himself among the stuff. And that was King Saul when he was supposed to be anointed king. He was hiding. So, seems to be an humble man. And then in verse 27, but the children of Belial said, how shall this man save us? And they despised him and brought him no presents, but he held his peace. So, he seems like a very respectable man at that point in his life, and we know that his course of life changed as he was king, became jealous. So, most likely, Jonathan had a good example as a child. He was Saul's top general. At a fairly young age, we don't know his exact age, but if you go to 1 Samuel, we're going to spend most of our time in 1 Samuel 13 and 14. But in 1 Samuel 13, verse 1, it says, Saul reigned 1 year, and when he had reigned 2 years over Israel, Saul chose him 3,000 men of Israel, whereof 2,000 were with Saul in Michmash and in Mount Bethel, and 1,000 were with Jonathan in Gibeah of Benjamin, and the rest of the people he sent every man to his tent. So he was in charge of 1,000 armed men. We don't know his age here, but it was in the second reign of King Saul's reign, so I don't know where this would put. In my head, I'm thinking 20s, low 20s maybe. Could be wrong on that. He was a man of conviction. He didn't follow in his father's footsteps, and we know that. By looking at his life, we see that, and there's some places where that comes out. We're close. Let's just turn. 1 Samuel 14, verse 29. This was after he had eaten the honey, and the people told him, hey, you're not supposed to do that. And in verse 29, he says, then said Jonathan, my father hath troubled the land. See, I pray you, how mine eyes have been enlightened, because I tasted a little of this honey. And it seems like he's just a little bit put out about his dad. He realizes his dad is taking Israel down a wrong path. He has troubled the land, he says, And then in chapter 20, verse 34, we see a little bit more of his conviction coming out. So Jonathan arose from the table in fierce anger and didn't eat no meat the second day of the month, for he was grieved for David because his father had done him shame. And now maybe that was more of a sticking up for his friend than a sticking up for principle. I'm not sure, but he definitely, we know David was a man of principle at this time in his life. And that's a whole other part of the story that I don't have time to get into, but how Jonathan stuck by David, even though he knew that David was the one that was going to take the kingdom from his family. So he was a man of principle. But what I want to look at this morning is his courage, his undaunting courage, and his heroic faith. And that's what I would like to look at. So let's start by looking, get a little bit of a political situation here that Israel was in chapter 13 of 1 Samuel. And let's read. Well, I'm going to go to the end. I'm going to start at verse 19 to 22. Now there was no smith found throughout all the land of Israel, for the Philistines said, lest the Hebrews make them swords or spears. But all the Israelites went down to the Philistines to sharpen every man his share and his coulter and his axe and his mattock. Yet they had a file for the mattock and for the coulter and for the forks and for the axes and to sharpen the goads. So it came to pass in the day of battle that there was neither sword nor spear found in the hand of any of the people that were with Saul and Jonathan, but with Saul and Jonathan, his son was there found. So the two swords. So we see here that Israel at this point was in a stranglehold by the Philistines. So much so that the Philistines had control of their ironworks. They said who didn't and who did do the ironworks. And of course the Philistines said, well, Israelites shouldn't do it because then they'll make themselves spears and we don't want that. So you got to come down to us. And so Israel was in a stranglehold here and the Philistines were comfortably controlling Israel and raiding them whenever they wanted to. So that was that was the political situation. That was the atmosphere here that the Israelites found themselves in. Very depressing. But then let's zero in on the situation that is the setting for our story today. So if you go back in chapter 13 to verse 3. And here we have Jonathan. And Jonathan, remember, he has 1,000 men to his name. And Jonathan smote the garrison of the Philistines that was in Geba. And the Philistines heard of it. And Saul blew the trumpet throughout all the land, saying, let the Hebrews hear. And all of Israel heard say that Saul had smitten a garrison of the Philistines, and that Israel also had an abomination with the Philistines. And the people were called together after Saul to Gilgal. And the Philistines gathered themselves together to fight with Israel, 30,000 chariots and 6,000 horsemen, and people as the sand which is on the seashore in multitude. And they came up and pitched in Michmash eastward from Beth-Aven. When the men of Israel saw that they were in a strait, for the people were distressed, then the people did hide themselves in caves and in thickets and in rocks and in high places and in pits. And some of the Hebrews went over Jordan to the land of Gad and Gilead. As for Saul, he was yet in Gilgal, and all the people followed him trembling. And so what we have is we have Jonathan taking his 1,000 men and making a heroic victory. Takes Geba, smites a garrison there, and a garrison is, well, there's not really a number. It's more or less, if you look at that description, it's a group of soldiers that's stationed to hold a point, or like a post of soldiers, and it could be various numbers. They varied in size, but there was soldiers they could move around. It wasn't like any fortification that was built. It's just soldiers. And so he smote this Philistine garrison, and Israel was, they were happy. Here's hope. Well, what did the Philistines do? If you look in verse 4, it says there that all Israel heard. They heard two things. They heard that Saul had smitten the garrison and that they had in abomination. And that simply means they were detested. Because what you have here is, remember, these Philistines are in control. And so basically you have this, like, the mouse biting the cat's tail. Like, seriously? What just happened? And these Philistines are just enraged. Like, you gotta be kidding. They only have two swords. And they were furious. And then they just pull out a couple men. They pulled out, as we see the numbers, an incredible army. They weren't just going for revenge. They were going for annihilation. I don't know if they were going to take them all out, but this was it. We had enough. So that's what we're up against. Now let's jump over to chapter 14. So this is the setting, this is the tension that Israel is under right now. Verse 23 of chapter 13, at the end there, says, "And the garrison of the Philistines went out to the passage of Michmash." Okay, so we have this garrison positioned at Michmash. In chapter 14, verse 1, "Now it came to pass upon a day that Jonathan, the son of Saul, said unto the young man that bare his armor, 'Come, let us go over to the Philistines' garrison that is on the other side.' But he told not his father. And Saul tarried in the uttermost parts of Gibeah under a pomegranate tree, which is in Migron, and the people that were with him were about 600 men. And Ahiah, the son of Ahitub, Ichabod's brother, the son of Phinehas, the son of Eli, the Lord's priest, and Shiloh wearing an ephod, and the people knew that Jonathan was gone. And between the passages by which Jonathan sought to go over unto the Philistine garrison, there was a sharp rock on one side and a sharp rock on the other side. And the name of the one was Bozes, and the name of the other, Sina. The forefront of the one was situated northward over against Michmash, and the other southward over against Gibeah. And Jonathan said to the young man that bare his armor, 'Come, let us go over unto the garrison of these uncircumcised. It may be that the Lord will work for us, for there is no restraint to the Lord to save by many or by few.' And his armor bearer said unto him, 'Do all that is in thine heart. Turn thee, behold, I am with thee according to thine heart.' Then said Jonathan, 'Behold, we will pass over unto these men, and we will discover ourselves unto them. If they say thus unto us, Tarry until we come to you, then we'll stand still in our place and will not go up to them. But if they say thus, Come up unto us, then we will go up, for the Lord hath delivered them into our hand. And this shall be a sign unto us.' And both of them discovered themselves unto the garrison of the Philistines, and the Philistines said, 'Behold, the Hebrews come forth out of the holes which they had hid themselves.' And the men of the garrison answered Jonathan and his armbearer and said, 'Come up to us, and we'll show you a thing.' And Jonathan said to his armbearer, 'Come up after me, for the Lord hath delivered them into the hand of Israel.' And Jonathan climbed up upon his hands and upon his feet, and his armbearer after him. And they fell before Jonathan, and his armbearer slew after him. And that first slaughter which Jonathan and his armbearer made was about 20 men within, as it were, an half acre of land which an yoke of oxen might plow. And there was trembling in the hosts, in the field, and among all the people, the garrison and the spoilers. They also trembled, and the earth quaked. So it was a very great trembling. And the watchmen of Saul and Gibeah of Benjamin looked, and behold, the multitude melted away. And they went on beating down one another. Then said Saul unto the people that were with him, Number now, and see who is gone from us. And when they had numbered, behold, Jonathan and his armor-bearer were not there." And we'll stop there. The story goes on. So I want to work through the story and just look at the courage that Jonathan had. And then we'll look at faith as it's kind of a second part. So first of all, the undaunting courage of Jonathan. What is courage? We know what courage is. The dictionary definition is the mental or moral strength to venture, persevere, and withstand danger, fear, or difficulty. And I think we all want it, and most of us think we have it, but the problem is we don't know if we have it because the quote goes, you can't test courage cautiously. You can't just see if I have courage. You have to go all in. You get thrown all in to whatever the problem is, whatever the fear is, whatever the struggle is. Then you know if you have courage or not. And we see that's where Jonathan was here. So in verse 1, he says to his armor bearer, let's go check out this Philistine garrison. And that took courage. It took courage to even just sneak over to the outskirts of Michmash and just see what this garrison looked like. Because remember, what's behind this garrison? 30,000 chariots. Now, I looked, and the Tyrone population was like 5,500, so 5,500-ish. So basically, you have six Tyrones, just chariots. Those are just chariots. And then you have another Tyrone of horsemen that can move swiftly. And then you have just a multitude. You can't count them. There's so many. Your footmen are just innumerable. That's what's behind Michmash. That's what they're up against. And Jonathan's like, let's go check this out. Well, he knew what it looked like. It was a terrifying sight, but he wanted to go check it out. You see courage. In verses 2 through 5, Saul tarried in the uttermost parts of Gibeah. So Saul he's down in Gibeah still. He's not sure what to do. And here's where I'd like to just draw a little bit of the geography here. because these verses are a little bit hard to understand. It definitely leaves out some specific geography, but it's like in my mind it never made sense. I always pictured Jonathan like sneaking up a ravine because you got a rock on this side and a rock on that side, and up there's the garrison, but it never made sense to me why you would sneak up on the low ground to survey something. That whole thing never made sense. But if you look at the Greek and the wording here, it does make a little more sense. So let's draw this and try to get a little mental picture. This is by no means gonna be to scale or anything. So Michmash was in the north. And we have Gibeah in the south. And then if you look at it, there is a pretty steep ridge that runs kind of the length here. It's mountainous over here. And there is a valley that kind of meanders from, I don't know if it's straight through, but again, this is a gross generalization. And then you have these two rocks over this way. We're going to make them sharp and pointy. So the name of the one was Bozes. We'll name him right away. And the other was Sinim. And I, as far as I can tell, would have been in this order. Bozes would have been against Michmash. It doesn't say that specifically. But from geography today, people have gone back and tried to lay this all out so you can find information on it. So this was all high ground, and I'm not sure how to do this other than maybe just make this kind of mountainous down through here and up through here. And of course, out this way, this is all mountainous out through here. So there's a very, very narrow ravine that runs in through here and joins up with this valley that runs through here. And the mountains kind of dissipate until you get to, you know, this is fairly flat down here. So if that makes sense at all, mountains run away. So what we have, well, let's read this. Let's read through this and we kind of add stuff as we go. So verse 4, and between the passages by which Jonathan sought to go over unto the Philistines. Now, what that would say, if you read that, it should read more like in the way of transit that Jonathan wanted to go in. Between the passage, between him and where he wanted to go, was this ravine, these sharp rocks. So what you have is Jonathan coming out here. So this is Jonathan and his armor bearer made this little scouting mission to this garrison. And the garrison was here. Philistine garrison. And so he is on the high ground. He kept the high ground, actually. And he goes over here and he's looking across this ravine at this Philistine garrison. Between the passages by which Jonathan sought to go over unto the Philistines. And it makes a little more sense to go over unto. He had to go over to the Philistine garrison on the other side. There was these sharp rocks, and it has them named, and that their names actually, Bozes means shiny one, and Sina means thorny one. So I don't know, it probably had some significance. And now you can visualize a little bit more what the Philistines had in mind. They had amassed all their forces right here. They were planning to rule down this valley, and remember, Saul's here. He's in Gibeah with his 600 men, not sure what to do. And so they are planning to wipe them out. And just as a side note, but in World War I, there was a British general that was supposed to go take out some Turkish forces in Michmash. And he remembered reading about Michmash in his Bible. And he actually went, and that night, before the night of the raid, before they were supposed to do it, he was searching through his Bible, and he found it, and he read it, and he got his other fella to look over it with him, and they sent out some scouts, and they found it. They found this pass and these rocks that the Bible has talked about, and he actually changed his plan of attack, and instead of sending his whole army like he was going to do, he sent a small group through this pass here, which was, they discovered, was very lightly guarded by the Turkish forces. And so they easily pushed the Turkish forces out of this. Basically, they were stationed somewhere in this area. But they came through this little pass here, and he was able to rout the Turkish forces without too much trouble. But it's just fascinating to me that Bible geography is that dead on. I mean, the Bible's accurate in everything, but even in geography, it's dead on. And this man actually used it to, in World War I, to accomplish his mission. Anyway, side note. Verse 6. And Jonathan said to the young man that bare his armor, come, let us go over unto the garrison of these uncircumcised. It may be that the Lord will work for us, for there is no restraint to the Lord to save by many or by few. And here I see courage. We can't just go over to the garrison. To go over here, we need to go down. It took courage for Jonathan to go down into that ravine because you're automatically at a disadvantage. You're giving up your high ground, and you're saying, let's go a little further. He's stepping in a little deeper. Courage. And then he doesn't stop there. He says in verse 7, and his armor bearer said, well, his armor bearer said to him, let's do it. I'm with you. And verse 8 then said, Jonathan, behold, we will pass over unto these men, and we will discover ourselves unto them. And so he just keeps wading in deeper. That courage is, and his courage is intact. He's like, let's go over and check it out. Okay, yeah, let's go do it. And then let's show ourselves to them while we're there. Now you're basically saying it's fight or flee. Once you're seen, You either retreat or you fight. It's not, I don't think so, and slip away again. You're basically saying it's one or the other. And I do have to note, the armor bearer has incredible courage too. Now, I don't know how old this boy was. If you look at Bible history, the armor bearers were typically young fellows, like younger than their commanders. So if he's 25, let's say, I mean, this fellow could be, I don't know, maybe he's still a teenager. They were usually pretty young, but he is totally loyal. He's like, he didn't even question Jonathan's plan. I mean, if it had been me, I'd been like, you may go, but I'm not going with you. He's like, hey, whatever's in your heart, let's do it. But well, we can't forget that this armor bearer was most likely with him when he took Jeba. And so he saw Jonathan do his work there. And so there was a little bit of a relationship between this fella. He had seen Jonathan fight before. So, they're going to show themselves. Once they show themselves, well, then it's either back out, flee, or fight. Jumping down to verse 12. And the men of the garrison answered Jonathan and his armor bearer, and they said, come up to us, and we'll show you a thing. And Jonathan said unto his armor bearer, come up after me, for the Lord hath delivered them into the hand of Israel. And he climbs up on his hands and upon his feet. Here we see the ultimate show of Jonathan's courage. Just, I can only imagine the heart pounding, the adrenaline rush, the whispering to his commander, or to his armor bearer, but their courage is alive. And like, we're going to do this. We're not backing down now. And he scrambles up on this enemy, on the enemy side, rock cliff, all fours. I can only imagine he was expecting a blow, a pain, a searing something, any step of that climb. Like, surely they're not going to wait till we get to the top to hit us. Like, every second he's just climbing, but he's all in. He reaches the top, he's still alive, and he doesn't hesitate, charges right into the enemy, which obviously the Philistines weren't quite ready for. I don't know if they thought he was going to try to gain his composure on the top, but it seems like as soon as he hit the top, he charged head on into these Philistines. They were not expecting it. Jonathan with his sword flying and his armor bearer after him, finishing them off, which, by the way, was the job of the armor bearer. That was their duty. They had to finish off any wounded that their sword man wounded. They had to finish him off. That was expected of the armor bearer. So this was how it worked. Were there two swords? Thought not, but then I thought maybe there was, because it does say, so they took Jeba. So when they took that garrison, did they get swords? Did they get the Philistine swords out of that deal? I don't know. They may have. But I'd still tend to think there was only one sword because it is at the end of chapter 13 where it references there was only two swords, and that's after they had taken Jeba. So I'm not sure. Not sure if that's all chronological there, but it would seem there might have been only one sword. That Jonathan would have had the sword, probably. And so another misconception here, that's in the way you read it, it can sound like he was like slaying them as he climbed, because it reads, "And Jonathan climbed upon his hands and upon his feet, and his armor bearer after him, and they fell before Jonathan, and his armor bearer slew after him." But, well, it doesn't seem possible, number one, which with God all things are possible, I understand that. But on the flip side, you aren't going to have Philistines just kind of waiting on the hillside, you know, staggered out, just waiting for him to come so they can hit him. They're going to be up on top waiting for him to come over the top to take him out. And then in verse 14, we have Jonathan and his armor bearer made was about 20 men within, as it were, an half acre of land which a yoke of oxen might plow. And there's a lot of discrepancy on what that phrase actually means, because in the original Greek, it reads within about half furrow of a yoke of land. And so you can see why it got translated the way it did. But they say that in that era of time, a yoke of land would have been the amount of land that a yoke of oxen could plow in a day, which in reality was not an acre. It was less than an acre, maybe closer to half an acre, one of our acres. And it says within about half furrow of a yoke of land. So now we're talking there's a little bit of room for some interpretation there. Half furrow, does that mean half of one of these yokes of land? That's what it would seem like. So now we're talking half of a half of an acre, which is about 75 feet square, which I think this church is, what, it's got to be close to 75 feet long, maybe a little more. So you're talking an area maybe this way, square. So the point is, it was a small area of land where these 20 men were taken out. And it was such a shocking thing that the rest of the Philistines thought this was a larger army than it was. They thought this was, whoa, 20 men already gone. And it struck fear into their hearts. And then God took it from there with an earthquake. Just send an earthquake. Just fascinating how God works. He used two courageous men to just strike a little fear into these Philistines' hearts, and then he helped out. But he wanted some men to take action first. I'm not just going to send an earthquake and wipe them all away. Go do something, and then I'll help you. He grew that fear as only God could with that earthquake, and we have a very great trembling, it says, and in my Bible, it gives a little side note. A trembling of God. So this was more than natural. And the watchmen of Saul, they saw these people fleeing, they saw them melting away, beating down one another, and they would, there was most likely some Hebrews in the Philistine ranks, captives that they believe turned on the Philistines. And so we have these people beating down each other and fleeing. And we didn't read that far, but it says on down how that the Israelites that were hiding started popping out of their hiding places and attacking the Philistines, which actually worked kind of like an ambush, because these guys are hiding all along the path and in the holes and in caves and in everywhere, it says. And when the Philistines started running, they started jumping out and actually created a bit of an ambush. But that all started with one man and his undaunting courage. What inspired that courage? Where did that courage come from? There's different things that inspire courage. The natural drive to survive will give you courage. People who do some crazy things to survive, cutting off limbs. I don't know. You do all kinds of things to survive. So that would inspire some courage. A sense of duty to protect others inspires courage. Just recently, the fire chief that was killed there at the Trump rally in Butler, protecting his family. Well, that's courageous, right? His sense of duty to protect his family. He was shielding his family from the bullets. He took them himself. It's courageous. Another person's display of courage can inspire courage in us. We see other people being courageous, and we want to rise to that. Generals have done it throughout the ages, as war generals. Rough Riders. Teddy Roosevelt. There he is. Teddy Roosevelt and his Rough Riders down in Cuba. And he was a courageous leader. One of those leaders that just rode his horse out ahead of us, and his men were like, well, there he goes. We need to follow. And so he inspired courage. But Jonathan didn't have anyone really here inspiring courage in him. He had the opposite, actually. His dad sitting back under the pomegranate tree. That wouldn't really inspire courage. Sense of duty to protect others, he might have had. Natural tendency to survive, maybe a little bit, because if we don't do something, we're going to be dead men. But I think the biggest drive here for his courage, which can be a drive in our life as well, is a faith in an almighty God. If we have faith in an almighty God, we can have courage. It inspires courage in us. And I think that is the ultimate inspiration for courage. All you need to do is read Martyr's Mirror, and you will find story after story of men and women, young and old, with undaunting courage because of a faith in an almighty God. And so I would like to look next at his heroic faith. Heroic faith. Jonathan had faith. And I would like to look through the story again and just pull out, find some of these characteristics. What are some of these characteristics of heroic faith? And it's not just for Jonathan on the battlefield, it's for us today. We can have this. Can be ours. So back at the beginning, and I kind of alluded to this already, but we see Jonathan saying to his armor bearer, come, let's go over to these Philistines. Let's go see what's going on. And the next verse says, and Saul tarried under the pomegranate tree. Heroic faith does not sit in the shade when there is a need. And we sing a song that says, true evangelical faith does not lie sleeping. Same thing. Heroic faith will not sit in the shade under the pomegranate tree when there's a need. It's going to be up and doing. It's going to be up seeing where it can serve. David and Goliath is a good example of this. David walks into that battlefield. He had no responsibility to take care of Goliath. He was just bringing his brother some food. And he gets there and he sees the situation and he's like, well, isn't there a cause? Like, this guy's he's an evil man. Let's take care of him. And he saw the need. And he didn't sit back and say, I don't blame you for not taking on that man. No, he saw the need, and he humbly did what he could. Abraham, he could have stayed in Ur. History tells us that Ur was a fairly, history and geography, geography. Can't think of the word. When you go dig up old artifacts. That kind of archaeology. Yes, thank you. They've discovered that, Ur had indoor plumbing. This wasn't some old town. This was up and coming. Ur had a very, very comfortable life. I'm sure Abraham felt pretty good there in Ur. But he saw the need to move out because of a call of God. He moves out, accepting God's call on his life. How are we doing? How am I doing? Individually, collectively, what are we doing? Are we getting out of our comfort zone? It's not easy. Are we getting out of our comfort zone? Are we rising to the challenges? Sometimes they're big, sometimes they're little. Are we accepting and serving the needs around us? Heroic faith will do that. Verse 6, Jonathan says to, he says, come, let's go over to this garrison, unto this garrison of these uncircumcised. It may be that the Lord will work for us, for there is no restraint of the Lord to save by many or by few. He saw the Philistines for who they were. Heroic faith sees the spiritual elements in a situation. He could have looked over there and said, I see a garrison that is representing an unstoppable army. We're not going to touch it. But no, he said, go to this garrison, these uncircumcised Philistines. He saw that these were enemies of God. He saw them for who they were. David and Goliath, same way. David had some, I guess we could turn there, 1 Samuel 17:24, it's not that far away. He says, and all the men of Israel, when they saw the man, fled from him and were sore afraid. And then we drop down to verse 26. And David spake to the men that stood by him, saying, what shall be done to the man that killeth this Philistine and taketh away the reproach from Israel? For who is this uncircumcised Philistine that he should defile the armies of the living God? That the spiritual elements were very clear in David's mind. We go over to verse 45 and 46. And then said David to the Philistine, thou comest to me with a sword and with a spear and with a shield, but I come to thee in the name of the Lord of hosts, the God of the armies of Israel, whom thou hast defiled. This day will the Lord deliver thee into mine hand, and I will smite thee and take thine head from thee, and I will give the carcasses of the host of the Philistines, and I will give the carcass of the host of the Philistines this day unto the fowls of the air and to the wild beasts on the earth, that all the earth may know that there is a God in Israel. The whole way through, he saw the spiritual elements, and that's what kept him focused. That's what brought him victory. If he had tried to do it on his own, it wouldn't have worked. Joshua, we could turn back. I don't think we'll take time for that. But Joshua and Caleb in Numbers, when they said, well, let's go take the land. And they used the words like, the land is bread for us. These people are nothing. They had the spiritual elements in mind. The other 10 did not. They saw giants and said, there's no way. The physical it's huge. We're never going to be able to do it. How is it for me? I know for myself, it's pretty easy to get focused on the physical realities because they're real, right? There's obstacles. Not always obstacles. Sometimes there's glamour, and we want that. But we focus on the physical, and we forget about the spiritual realities. We forget about the spiritual side of it, which actually is more real, can we say, because it's eternal. We forget why we're here. We're not here for the glamour. We forget that every person we meet has a soul and they're headed somewhere. One of two places. We forget about that. I do. We forget our possessions won't matter in the end. Not gonna matter. Cannot forget the physical realities are not what they appear. Spiritual realities are way more real, are way more consequential, I guess we should say. Also in verse 6, we see that heroic faith doesn't get hung up on the math. Heroic faith has total confidence in an unlimited power of an almighty God. Now that's too many adjectives for me. That's too many big words for my small brain. But that's okay because we're not talking about intellect here. We're talking about faith. And intellect actually limits us when it comes to faith. We need to remember that. You can have we should have intellect. We should study to learn. We should study to know. But if that's where it stops, we've got a problem because faith goes way beyond the intellect. I like math and I like when things hold out. I like when things add up. I like when it makes sense. I think we all do. But the fact of the matter is that with God, it doesn't always make sense. It doesn't always add up, and we don't always know why. Elijah in the contest with the prophets of Baal, 1 against 400. Like, that's the physical. 1 against 400? There's no way. Fire against water? No, it doesn't work. It never did. Well, it did sometimes when God was involved. God against Satan? Yeah, that's what it was. That's what the battle was. So 400 to 1 and fire to water doesn't make a difference. All of a sudden, the physical realities become pointless when the spiritual elements, when the spiritual realities are real. Because when we say God against Satan, well, that's not even a contest. I mean, God's got it, right? And jumping down to verse 9 and 10. So Jonathan says, if they say thus unto us, tarry until we come, then we'll stay here. But if they say, come on up to us, then we'll go up because we're going to get them. And it struck me how he made the hardest and most likely option the yes, we're going to do it And I guess heroic faith doesn't seek direction selfishly. What I mean by that is he could have said, if they say, come up to us, then we're going to go home. Because there's obviously no way we can do it, right? If they say, we'll come down to you, then yeah, we'll stay here and the Lord will help us. He could have done that. There was nothing that made him do what he did other than the fact that he was very courageous and he had a faith that saw the spiritual elements. But heroic faith doesn't seek direction selfishly. It's pretty easy to find someone who's going to, you know, tell you you should do what you want to do, or to find someone that will tell you not to do something that God might be calling you to do. All you have to do is go to, I think I'd written that reference down, 1 Kings is where Jehoshaphat, when he was going to go fight with Ahab, they were going to join and go fight, and he said, well, call some prophets, and they called the 400 prophets out, and the 400 prophets said, yes, go. And he's like, what? Isn't there another prophet? Well, yeah, there's one, but he never says what I want him to say. Well, okay, he's like, it's ridiculous, right? But we do the same thing. We can. You know, well, I don't really want to, so if I go ask so-and-so, he'll probably say I shouldn't. So heroic faith doesn't seek direction selfishly. And I would say, if we're going to lay out a fleece, he wasn't laying out a fleece here necessarily, but if we're going to lay out a fleece, let's make sure we don't tilt it in our favor. Because sometimes you can. Sometimes you can lay out a fleece and we'll make the most likely option be the no. Faith won't do that. Heroic faith won't do that. We'll tilt it in our disfavor. And that just inspired me when I saw that, how Jonathan says, if they say come up, then we're going to go. To me, I can get hung up on, that doesn't really seem like a sign. I mean, of course they're going to tell us to come up. I mean, they want to kill us, right? I mean, yeah, they're going to tell us to come up. But he says, that's our sign that we're going to go and do it. And I guess they could have said, go away. You know, God could have made them do anything, and that's where he was leaving in God's hands. That if God actually wants us to go do it, then they're going to tell us to come. Verse 12, moving on here. And the men of the garrison answered Jonathan, and they said, come up, we'll show you a thing. And Jonathan said unto his armor bearer, come up after me, for the Lord hath delivered them into the hand of Israel. And I love the way he says that. Heroic faith believes that God will. He hath delivered them. They didn't even get up there yet. They're still standing at the bottom. He says, the Lord delivered them into our hands. It's like past, half, or what do you say, present perfect maybe. It's being perfected. He's doing it. And that is a stretch for me. When I'm at the bottom of the mountain, can I look up and say, it's going to happen. We're going to get them. We're going to get this problem. We're going to, you know, whatever it is. But heroic faith believes that God will. Abraham, in offering Isaac, Hebrews would say that, well, he believed that God could raise him back to life. Yeah. There's a way. God will do it. George Mueller, inspiration. He's a fascinating fellow. Man of faith, had those orphanages in Bristol, England, and just incredible faith. He never, asked for money. It was always donation. He never wanted to ask for money. And I still remember, we had a story hour growing up. If you have story hours, they're great. Listen to them. They stick things in your head that you'll never forget. And the one I still remember is, it was George Mueller, and they were out of food, and they needed breakfast. They had no food in the orphanage, and it was in the evening. They had breakfast. They had no food for breakfast tomorrow morning. So they prayed that night, and they went to bed. At least I think they did. Slept a little bit, maybe. And the next morning, sure enough, the bread truck broke down, and they had to get rid of the bread. So they went and knocked on the orphanage door, because it was right beside the orphanage, and so they had tons of bread. They had lots of breakfast. But now it was just bread. And I think that's where I get hung up sometimes, because what God does may not be what my flesh wants. I can have faith, but I don't want to commit the whole way, because what if he only gives me bread for breakfast? And I want more. And that's where myself gets in the way. But it'll always be sufficient, and it'll always be for my good. Do I believe that God will in my life? Like Jonathan did here, do I believe that he will? When I totally surrender, do I believe that he will? Well, I'm sure there's a lot more we could pull from this account, but My desire for myself in studying this and for you all here this morning is that we can grow in this heroic faith, in this undaunting courage, this week and in the weeks ahead. Let's kneel for prayer.